And before we go any further, I would like to thank a few listeners who took time to support what we do. And Tyrone Ford, you're one of them. Thank you very much. Bronx is in the house. And also I would like to thank, it doesn't say yes or no, so I would like to thank that generous person in Freeport, and that's New York. Thank you very much for getting the ALD history package, even though we did not play some of the elements yet, but that's a very valuable package. That's the package featuring Dr. Sheikh Hamdi Diop on tape, talking about the history of humankind, chronologically speaking. And also Dr. Ben talking about the relevance of the sovereignty of Ethiopia or Eritrea. And thank you very much. And also I would like to thank another one. There is no yes or no whether we should thank you, but this is coming from Broad Street, Newark, broader than Broadway. That is Newark, Broad Street, Newark. Thank you very much. And thank you for also your support to T-Dub shout out line. And thank you very much. And also I would like to thank another person, and this one that doesn't say yes or no, but this is coming from Lexington Avenue, and this is the African Origins of Mathematics. Thank you very much for supporting WBAI. And we're moving slowly but surely this morning, and I would like to take a minute to, just share with you the African origins of physics as understood and presented by Dr. John Papademore, who happened to be a Greek himself, and this was his contribution on that particular panel discussion. And Los Hombres Calientes coming strong and hard. Again, Irvin Mayfield on horns and Bill Summers on percussion with many, many special guests. And when they do it, they really seem to do it right. And you're listening to now track number New Bus Stop. And stay tuned. And while you're listening to the African Origins of Physics, I'm urging you to call 212-209-2950. And as Marjorie Moore says, every morning while you're about to leave home, walk away with the number 212-209-2950. And when you get to work, you could still make your phone calls, or you could call somebody and say, please call this number and do this for me. And just give them the title, what you want, and we'll help you. Thank you very much and stay tuned.
Center for the Comparative Study of Humanities for this opportunity to speak. I would like to can everyone see those titles there? These are some of the major sources that have inspired me and I've made use of. The first one written in 1946, I believe, by W.E.B. Du Bois on the world in Africa, pioneering work, and George Sarton, the Harvard historian of science, for his history. Chikanta Diop, the late Chikanta Diop, for his book, The African Origin of Civilization, which he took up where Du Bois left off, and it was an important study of the black African origins of ancient Egypt and why ancient Egypt must be considered an integral part of Africa. And finally, I would like to add a more recent book by Martin Bernal. Professor Bernal is we're favored with his presence. He's in the audience today, who has done important work that adds further evidence to the importance of ancient Egypt as influencing and in the origins of physics. Did you get my folder? I think is it there somewhere? Here it is. Thank you. I wanted to show you this slide at this particular point in connection with Diop's work, this is a slide, or rather a transparency of Queen Mother Tai, the Queen Mother and Empress, who was the wife of Amenophis III, who consolidated Egypt in the Middle Period, her son Akhenaten, which Beatrice Lumpkin mentioned earlier, was the pharaoh who initiated monotheism. And this is another view of Empress Tai. And there's no question about a black African Egyptian. I will come back to this subject later. At any rate, reading these books that I mentioned had led me about 15 years ago to analyze the way in which physics textbooks present the history of science. And I asked some of my physics students to analyze a number of physics texts, and I learned from that survey that never was Africa mentioned as being the origin of any part of science, nor any African, nor any African American. Physics was supposed to have somehow magically sprung to birth on European soil somewhere around 600 BC with the first famous Greek scientist, Thales. The book by a reading of Sarton's book on the history of science, however, which was written in 1952, showed that science can't be considered to have sprung as some sort of miracle, but was rather the product of many centuries and even thousands of years of evolution of human civilization. So if we ask, where did mankind evolve, all the evidence points to an African origin. It's difficult to find out how far that science progressed in Africa in the first tens and hundreds of thousands of years of mankind's existence in that period, because of the lack of evidence. Some of the evidence, Professor Lumpkin showed the Ishango bone tool, but there is really very little archaeological evidence so far. A lot more work needs to be done. But about 6,000 or 7,000 years ago, a great civilization arose in the Valley of the Nile, in the southern reaches, in Nubia, Ethiopia, and it spread northward rapidly to the Mediterranean. And this civilization left us written records of their achievements. And it was there that the ancient Egyptians and Nubians gave the world what is perhaps their greatest contribution to science, the invention of writing. With the ability to record the results of operations of natural phenomena, science took a great leap forward. The other scientific, I can mention just a few in the time that I have, scientific achievements of the ancient Egyptians. Professor Lumpkin mentioned the calendar, which is based on astronomical observations, and it gives us our first fixed date in human history, somewhere greater than 4,000 BC, according to George Sarton. Egyptian calendar is still the one we use today with two minor modifications. The first modification was to add a day every 4 years, called leap year, That's when the year is divisible by four. And the scientist who advised Julius Caesar to do this was an African named Sosigenes. The second modification was the so-called Gregorian calendar, and that consisted in not adding a day in century years unless the century year is divisible by 400, such as the year 2000. Now the century we're coming up now to the year 2000, and that will will be a leap year, but 1900 was not a leap year. The Egyptian calendar was the world's first scientific measurement of time, one of the fundamental quantities of physics. Today, as Professor Lumpkin mentioned, we start the day at midnight because of thanks to Africans. We divide the day into 24 hours thanks to the Africans. We have 12 months in the year thanks to the Africans. And 5,500 years later, the Polish astronomer Copernicus was able to use the scientifically recorded observations of the Egyptians and others and the Egyptian calendar to put forth his theory of the rotation of the planets about the sun, a theory which had first appeared in Egypt many centuries earlier for measuring For measurement of shorter intervals of time, the Africans invented sundials and water clocks. We can understand the principle of the water clock better. I don't know if you can see this. Anybody recognize what I have in my hand? It's an egg timer. Sometimes it's known as an hourglass. You tilt it upside down and sand flows through a tiny aperture here. And after 2 minutes, in this case, when it's all gone, your egg is done. Well, instead of using sand, you can use water. That's the principle of the water clock. And at first, the water clocks that the Egyptians used just were used to measure a definite interval of time, let's say 2 minutes, 5 minutes, or an hour, whatever. Of course, they had to be careful about the hole through which the water dripped and make sure that it was not crusty or anything like that, because that would slow down the flow. But in order to turn the that device into an accurate instrument for measuring intervals, let's say 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and so forth, they had to use a little bit, had to use a trick. If I can find this. This is an improved version of a water clock due to an Alexandrian physicist. And you can see that there are two vessels there, one of which is maintained full. The top one, the water flows from some other place, A, and makes the container, B, always full. This maintains what's known as a constant head. The pressure that causes the water to drip out through C depends on the height of the water above it. And if you don't have that height, it won't flow at a constant rate. With this modification, the water can drip at a steady rate down into C, and simply by measuring the amount of water in that last, the lowest vessel here, the time can be measured. The purpose of that floating stick there is to, you can have a scale on it, and it will simply read minutes or whatever time interval you want to read. I wanted to mention this water clock because I wrote a paper once in which I asserted that the angular diameter of the sun could be was in fact measured by early Egyptians using water clocks, and a critic said that's impossible. You don't have to, you have to have something that will measure to an accuracy of 1 in 1,000. And anyone who knows elementary physics knows that too. Well, I don't think that person knew elementary physics, because the principle of measuring the angular diameter of the sun is not that difficult. If you want to measure what angle the sun subtends, you don't look directly at it, because that would blind you, even if you had a telescope. But what you can do is wait until sunrise, just as the sun is coming up over the horizon. When you first see the rim of the sun's disk appear over the horizon, you can start your water clock. It'll take about I don't know, 2, 3, maybe 5 minutes, and when you see the bottom part of the sun up above the horizon, you know that the sun has completely risen above the horizon. Knowing that time interval, which is quite measurable, and then using simple proportions, you can calculate the angular diameter of the sun. And the way you do it is to realize, for example, on the either equinox, March 21st, the sun in Egypt at Syene goes across the meridian straight overhead, and it will take exactly 12 hours to cover the entire half circle from horizon to horizon. So by simply dividing the number of minutes by 12 hours, the number of minutes it took it, the disk to rise by 12 hours, you set that equal to the ratio of the angular diameter to 180 degrees, and you got it. So it's this was done thousands of years before. This water clock was still used more than 2,000 years after the first Greek philosopher appeared on the scene, Thales. And as late as the time of Galileo, he used the water clock in his studies of accelerated motion. That was around 1600 A.D. And I have seen physics texts which give Galileo the credit for inventing the water clock. Europe is indebted to Africa for standards used in measuring other basic quantities such as length and weight. The first international unit of length was a cubit. That was mentioned by Professor Lumpkin also, the distance from the elbow to the tip of the middle finger. And that was used as late as the time of Galileo also. They called it the braccio. To measure weights, they had units for weights measurements even before writing was invented. I just came across an article that Professor Lumpkin gave me that showed that Egyptians had units for weight even before their invention of writing. They had instruments to measure weights, of course, pan balances, which are fundamentally the same principle as I use today in physics classes. And that's basically an application of the lever, which is supposedly an invention of Archimedes, a Greek who died in 212 B.C., he is supposed to have said, "Give me a place to stand and I can move the earth." But the lever is shown in use in Egyptian temple paintings dating back to thousands of years prior to Archimedes. I will have a slide to show that later. There's not enough time in this lecture to further discuss the achievements of the Egyptians in science and engineering, all of which occurred long before famous Greek students of science, such as Plato, Thales, Democritus, Eudoxus, and Pythagoras, traveled to Egypt to study. We should stop a minute and think what that implies. These Greek philosophers and scientists were so stupid as to not realize they were wasting their time by taking a trip which must have been pretty difficult in those days. You just couldn't make a reservation on TWA and get there the next day. And then going to the trouble of learning an African language, Egyptian, because that's what they had to do if they were going to spend their time, and then spending years far away from their native land. It was 22 years in the case of Pythagoras. Professor Bernal is engaged in writing a series of books with the title of Black Athena. I had mentioned that. And in this book, he gives very compelling arguments to show that far from being backward and uncivilized, Africa was so far in advance of European Greece that it exerted dominant influence over the development of Greek language and culture in the early rise of ancient Greek civilization, say prior to 1600 B.C. At that time, the Nile Valley science and technology was far in advance of the Greeks and had been so for at least a couple of thousand years. Perhaps later during the discussion, we can ask Professor Bernal to summarize and explain in layman's terms just how he was able to do it. I can say this much, that it's based on the idea that ancient Greek, or one of his arguments is it's based on the fact that ancient Greek has only about 50% of its roots in the Indo-European language family of languages, and the rest can be traced to the Egyptian language and to also Phoenician roots. For example, the word pyramid comes from Greek, but if you go back further, you find that that's an Egyptian word. It comes directly from Egyptian. That implies that that Greece was at one time under the influence, if not the colonization, of Egypt. And there's other evidence of that. Now, let's move forward in history. Just because the Nile Valley was so much more advanced scientifically than Greece, and I might add Macedonia, which is a country just to the north of Greece, it didn't follow that Egypt would become and remain the dominant military power of that time. We can find other examples in history in which a country not especially advanced in science becomes the supreme military power, and in fact subjects other nations to its rule. And a good example of that is right here, the United States. The United States, after World War I, was so backward in science, all leading U.S. scientists had to go to Europe to study. The study of French and German was obligatory for advanced physics students. But today, France and Germany are not that dominant in the world, but rather the United States, because it's the world's strongest military and political power. And today, the international language of science is English, and not French or German. And graduate students of physics today no longer usually have to study French or German, because most articles that are read by the international physics community are written in English. So, likewise, it came to pass that Egypt fell under the rule of Alexander of Macedon, as well as a good part of the rest of the world. And just as today, where the dominant language of the United States, English, has become the international language of science, so Greek became the international language of science. The influence of Greek was so strong that even today, Greek words account for about 12% of the English vocabulary. But under Greek rule, Egypt continued to be the world's leading center of scientific research. It was Alexandria, a city on African soil bearing Alexander's name, that became the world center of scientific work and remained so for centuries. The standard versions of the history of science ask us to accept the idiotic notion that Greece, which was supposedly the world's most advanced nation in science at that time, would go to Africa to establish their scientific research center. Now, why would they want to go to Africa to establish a scientific research center if Greece was the most advanced scientific country in the world? Well, Professor Lumpkin has already dealt with the question of were the scientists of Alexandria Greek? And we know that the Eurocentric version of the history of science that is universally taught today, they are always referred to as Greek, never, never, never as African. Although practically nothing is known of their origins, there's some of them were probably Greek. But the ancient historians tell us were born in Greece and later moved to Alexandria, but there is evidence that some were not Greek, but Egyptian. And I'd like to talk about for a little bit about two of the greatest, Chiron and Ptolemy. Let me see if I'll. Now, Chiron, let me quote from a book by James Gow, A Short History of Greek Mathematics. I'm quoting now. It is now commonly believed that Chiron was an Egyptian. His name, if it is Greek at all, is found only in a late era and belongs to persons of Egyptian or Oriental birth. Gow goes on to give other reasons for supposing that Chiron was Egyptian. The reasons involve the style of writing and the language that Chiron used in his books. Let's talk a little bit about the work of Chiron. Heron was a combination of a mathematician, an experimental physicist, theoretical physicist, and an engineer. In addition to inventing the world's first steam engine, which was still used today as a demonstration in physics laboratories, Hero's engine. The principle of it is that you heat a tank of water from below, steam comes up, goes into that globe, and then it can escape through two pipes cocked at angles there at H and K. This involves not only the use of steam as a propulsive power, but also the principle of the jet engine. So this was, 1,000, 1,500 years before James Watt. The only problem was this was not used commercially at the time. It was still a toy, an interesting toy. Hero wrote several books on optics and mechanics and mathematics. One of his pioneering results in optics was to establish the principle of least time. Let me discuss that. Suppose you have a source of light at a point P. Imagine a light bulb or something like that. And the point Q is over here. Let's suppose maybe your eye is there, and this flat horizontal surface is a reflecting surface like a mirror. How does a ray of light get from point P, where it originates, over to your eye at Q? Well, it might go by this path A, bouncing down to here and then bouncing over to there. But in fact, the actual path is always the one in solid lines here that travels to Q and makes an angle with the perpendicular shown by the dotted line, such that this angle, which we call the angle of incidence, is equal to the other angle called the angle of reflection. That's the actual path it always follows, never a path like this. The path that it actually follows is actually the principle of least time. The ray takes the least time to go from P to Q. This is called a minimal principle. This discovery was applied to refraction almost 2,000 years later by the French scientist Fermat, and today is taught to physics students as Fermat's principle, with no credit to Heron. The importance of this principle in modern physics is hard to overemphasize. In 1965, Richard Feynman received the Nobel Prize in Physics for his quantum theory of light, called quantum electrodynamics, which is based on an extension of the principle of least time. Now let's talk about the work of Ptolemy. Around the first century A.D., or a little before, there flourished in Alexandria one of the greatest scientists who ever lived, known as Claudius Ptolemaeus, or simply Ptolemy for short. This Ptolemy should not be confused with the Ptolemaic dynasty. There was a succession of pharaohs that ruled Egypt after Alexander the Great conquered Egypt, and they all had the name Ptolemy. Ptolemy I, Ptolemy II, Ptolemy III, and so forth. But Ptolemy by itself just is always refers to the scientist, Ptolemy. He had nothing to do with those rulers. The only connection is a very indirect one. Some of them, the first ones especially, encouraged science, and so they provided the resources for the great museum at Alexandria to be set up, and the books and the scientists to come there and so on, be paid salaries. Now, without any evidence to back them up whatsoever, writers of physics and astronomy texts usually refer to Ptolemy as Greek, and never, never, never as an African. Recently, Professor Bernal has come across evidence that Ptolemy was an Egyptian. In an ancient Arabic historical account, he is referred to as an Egyptian. And that is evidence that he was an Egyptian. And as Professor Lumpkin pointed out, he lived in Africa, he died in Africa, he worked in Africa. So, he's an African. He produced, Ptolemy, a book or a work so brilliant that it was to become the Bible of astronomy for the next 14 centuries. I wonder how many other books there are in science that become universally used for that long. Not many. I would like to discuss this work of Ptolemy in a little bit more detail. Ptolemy's work on astronomy is usually referred to by its Arabic name, the Almagest, which means the great book. I have it here, as well as two other books that I'm going to refer to later. The first third of this book or so is devoted to the Almagest. In addition to writing this book, which contains a lot that is Ptolemy's own theoretical work, and based on his own astronomical observations, he summarized all of the historical data of the world in this book, and it was, as I said, the authoritative work on astronomy on the structure of the universe. He is responsible for the invention of an improved astrolabe, and that's an instrument for determining easily the exact positions of stars and planets. We still use his system of magnitudes for classifying the brightness of stars. For example, we talk about sixth magnitude stars and first magnitude stars and so forth. He used this system in his catalog. He had 1,300 stars in the catalog. Try going out at night and counting stars and see if you can come up with 1,300 stars. He had them all there in exact numbers. The book is quite mathematical. If you look at it, it starts off with theorems of geometry and spherical trigonometry. We are indebted to Ptolemy for the ideas of latitude and longitude, which we still use, by the way, today. He also knew, of course, that the Earth was spherical in shape, a fact that many Europeans were not willing to accept until many centuries later. Now, over the years, a lot has been made of the fact that Ptolemy's work is based on a false hypothesis, the so-called geocentric theory, which assumes that the sun, the moon, and the planets all revolve around us on the Earth. The Earth is the center of the universe. In the top there, I show the geocentric hypothesis. In the center is the Earth and the moon, and the sun and the planets. I've just shown one of them, Mars, all rotating in circles around us. This was a geocentric hypothesis. Now, it should be understood, though, that included in Ptolemy's Almagest were his theories of the structure of the whole universe, including the planets and their motions. Now, the planets, because they are their very name in Greek implies that they wander, and they're not like the stars. The stars remain fixed, but the planets kind of move around, and they'll be in one constellation of stars 1 month, and then another one maybe a few months later in a different constellation, so they kind of wander through the sky, and their motion is complicated. And so simply assuming that they travel in circles about the Earth won't do it. So Ptolemy's methods enabled one to predict with precision the dates of eclipses, or where the planet Jupiter would be in the sky on a certain date of any given year with the data available. At Ptolemy's time, the geocentric hypothesis as in the simple form that I've shown it there, was not enough. But he devised, and others before him, his was the most complicated, a system of epicycles in which the planets not only rotate in circles, but also circles on circles. And as in the simple form that I've shown it there, was not enough. But he devised, and others before him, his was the most complicated, a system of epicycles in which the planets not only rotate in circles, but also circles on circles. And with those epicycular type of motions, he was able to fit the data fairly well. and it gave the most accurate predictions of the positions of the planets. Ptolemy was quite well aware of the heliocentric theory. And that theory was most likely African in origin. There is no proof that any Greek was the author of it. But he rejected the heliocentric theory and in favor of a heliocentric theory with these epicycles, because if you simply assume that the Earth and the planets revolved in circles around the Earth, or rather around the Sun, it simply wouldn't fit the data. 14 centuries later, a Pole named Copernicus was to write a book entitled On the Revolutions of the Heavenly Spheres. I have that book here too. It's in the middle section. And this book was modeled closely on the Almagest. Titled, he wrote it in Latin, because at that time all major scientific works were written in Latin, and that didn't imply that he was Latin, he was a Pole. But and he, as I said, he modeled it. It's almost, for the first part at least, it looks like just a somewhat improved version of the Almagest. Remember now, Ptolemy had the advantage of centuries of careful observations by, especially by the Muslim astronomers like al-Battani. He refers to them constantly, but he also refers to Ptolemy constantly. He follows Ptolemy's proofs quite often, almost to the letter. So he does give credit to where he got his ideas. He, by the way, he includes trigonometrical tables in there, but they're not called trigonometry. They're called tables of chords, but in essence, they are trigonometrical, and those are very similar to Ptolemy's tables of chords. Copernicus, like Ptolemy, gives a catalog of stars and their positions, and he used, to take his measurements, the same instruments that Ptolemy used. And that's the astrolabe that I talked about earlier, which was the most advanced version of that instrument was built by Ptolemy. Now, Copernicus based the rest of his book on the heliocentric hypothesis. And the heliocentric hypothesis was, as I had it on the screen before, the idea that the sun is the center of the universe, and around the sun revolved the first Mercury, the innermost planet in a circle, Venus, the next largest circle or orbit, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, and so on. They were all revolved in circles. Now, Copernicus wasn't able to, as I said earlier, simply saying that the planets revolve in circles around the sun isn't good enough. They don't really, we'll see in a minute, that they don't revolve in circles. And so he had to use epicycles like Ptolemy did in order to make his data fit. As a result, his book wasn't, his ideas weren't immediately accepted. As a matter of fact, he held up publication, supposedly, until his deathbed, and then he was not afraid anymore that he might be burned at the stake. And his book was published after that. But it wasn't immediately accepted. It's because it didn't fit the data that much better than Ptolemy's book. Now, 3 years after Copernicus died, that was the year 1543, a rich Danish nobleman named Tycho Brahe was born. And I believe one of the moons of Jupiter, if I'm not mistaken, is named after Tycho. Tycho Brahe had a great interest in astronomy, and so with the money that he had an observatory built, which he used most of his life, taking the most accurate data possible for the motions of the planets. He took on an assistant, a poor bright German named Johannes Kepler, and I have a picture of him somewhere. This is Kepler. He had a very, very sad life. His children died of smallpox, I believe. He was poor most of his life. But eventually he wound up as an assistant for Kepler. And after Kepler died, he started to work making use of Kepler's data that he had accumulated with his observatory. And he spent years working, trying to explain the paths followed by the planets, because, as I said, Copernicus's work didn't really fit the data that well. He actually worked most of his life on this project. Finally, he succeeded publishing 3 laws of planetary motion, and he wrote a couple of books. The first 2 laws he published first, and then about 10 years later, the 3rd law. Let's see if I have these laws here. Yeah, I do. The first law is that the planets move in ellipses around the sun, not circles. An ellipse is like a flattened circle. And the sun not being at the center, but rather at one focus, off to one side, as you can see sort of in that diagram. And this is how every planet moves, in an ellipse. Not all ellipses were identical, and they were, of course, at different sizes. The ellipse for Mercury, the closest planet, was the smallest ellipse, and so on. The second law says that the a line joining any planet with the sun sweeps out equal areas in equal time. And like this line here, at this part of its orbit, when the planet is far away from the sun, it doesn't go as fast, and so the area it sweeps out is the same as when the planet is at its so-called perihelion, so when it's close to the sun, then it's moving faster and sweeps out a larger area, but the 2 areas are equal. So this is a longer height to move. Basically, the second law simply says that when the planet is close to the sun, it's moving faster.
Beguiled by blue moon, oh, enchanting light, we lost our way like lovers sometimes do, searching wide-eyed for wildflowers in the fragrant forest of the night. Now memories slowly drift on by like gray clouds against the somber winter sky, and all our yesterdays are now become the springtime of our days. The greatest teacher, love is the lesson to be learned. Like how the heart season shifts, how the sweet smelling blossoms of spring are soon become the icy arrows of winter's sting. How spring intoxicates.
212-209-2950 is the number to call. This is your very last chance to get this package, The African Origins of Mathematics and Physics. You are just listening to Dr. John Papa Damour, a Greek himself, talking about the African origins of physics. Earlier, we gave you Dr. Beatrice Lumpkin talking about the African origins of mathematics. And in a little while, we're going to bring you the African origins of humanity with an interview with Dr. Shekhamte Diop, a videotape featuring two parts, one talking about the African origins of humanity, as well as all the essential elements one needs to have a strong science. So this is your last time to get these packages. As I said, until late tonight, we're going to be offering you some of the packages we have offered during the membership drive. And the only new one we have added on this day would be a workshop with Dr. Mwata and Karen Ashby. And this is for those who have called for the past couple of weeks to acquire those packages, the Egyptian yoga, the African origins of yoga. We're going to have a workshop. For $100, you could be part of that workshop, and this is the BAI workshop. They're going to be coming in town, and this is going to take place no later than the first week of July. For $100, you will get this package. But I'm telling you right now, we are offering you the African origins of mathematics and physics for $150. You could get both. And if you want to just get the African origins of physics, which is what you heard, you could get it for $75. If you want to get the African origins of mathematics, you could get it for $100. And I urge you to get on your phone, because this is your very last chance to get these packages. I don't know when we're going to offer it again, and we have to move on because we have quite a bit to share with you. And the number to call is 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950, and this is for those who have not made the move yet to get to their phones and support this registration and support what we do. Support us in what we do, because yes, indeed, we are debunking the myth that's probably fettering your mind and your pocket inside to a certain degree. And this is very important. That's very important information. This is information that you need to have in your catalog, in your sound files, in your library, to share with your families, loved ones, and colleagues, and those you think need to hear and know. And as you heard earlier, we're telling you, if you happen to be a teacher, a math teacher or a physics teacher, whether you are teaching lower, from primary school to all the way down to the universities, yes, you need to know. You need to have that balance. You need to find that balance yourself, so that you could better teach the curriculum that you have in your hand, even though it's not telling you the true history of the subject matters. And it is very important for you to let us know that you're out there, you're listening, and call 212-209-2950 is the number to call to support us in what we do here on WBAI. It is very important. This is the very last time we're going to offer these packages, and I tell you, in a little while, we're going to get into a different package. This is the very last time we're going to share it with you. There's a lot more to come, and there's a lot more you can hear from these same packages, but then again, we're doing quite all right from when we started, but we need to do better. We need to do better. We need to hear you if you're out there. I know some of you on your way to work, but we have told you that you need to keep this number all day long throughout the night, which is 212-209-2950, 209-2950, and call at any point during the day. And when we replay, or when we get back into some of these materials that we have given you in the past couple of weeks, we would like to do it and move on, so that you don't have to be hammered with this subject matter again, because as I said, there's no turning back, and we have a lot to offer. And we want you to understand that this is brought to you by yourself. And the only way we can maintain it like that, brought to you by yourself, by your support, is for you to call and be part of this experience. Support what we do. 212-209-2950. You could have been African, you could have been black, white, checkered, zebraed, leopard, or whatever you call it, blue. But this is the history of humanity, and it's a package that you deserve to have, to know, and you deserve to somehow, at least if you're looking for bragging rights, or, some people like to, invite people and have discussions and arguments on issues. I mean, this one will put you over the top, because once you play it, they're going to be like, come on, man, where did you find this? Is this true? Is this real? So, you know what? Let's be a little hard now. Since you're not responding as well as I thought that you would, we're going to go egbemio, which means carry me. And you need to carry us. We need to be carried through this process. And this is coming from Fela Anokula Fokuti, and it's called Carry Me. Egbemio. Egbe. EBGE. or EGBE, Egbe, Mio, MIO, Egbe Mio, carry me now. I want to move. That's it. Let's march on. Let's march on back home.
That's it.
Two 2092952 is the number to call. Be part of this experience.
And keep calling, you know. Keep calling through the busy signals because you are reaching us.
Yeah.
Those of you, especially with your credit card numbers ready, you're getting through. For some reason, we are superseding all negativity this morning, and we're sailing right over it. Jabel and I are having a good time
just
here.
Carry,
that's it.
Just carry us on. Egbemio, fello. You can't be funkier than this, you know.
No, you
can't. Africa coming at you again.
Back to my roots. Hey, Hopsy, you don't like this? I bet he's got a few moves.
No, the Jamaicans don't know music, man. All of you y'all don't know music.
All right, now.
I'm going to sing now. You don't call. You better call now. I'm going to be singing.
Woo!
Here we go. We have 3 callers on the line, and we need more.
212-209-2950. And we need you to, those of you who are committed to the cause, we need you to call. We need you to make that extra step. Take that extra step in your own behalf. Let's hear from Harlem and Bedford-Stuyvesant. Thank you for that call.
Harlem, I'm true.
Come
with
on,
you.
Washington
North
Heights.
Harlem so far.
That's it.
This morning.
Brownsville. Come on, people.
We see Newark. We see Plainfield. We see the Bronx. We see Brooklyn.
That's right.
No Harlem at all.
Thank you. Uh-huh. There it comes.
Harlem, Egbemio, carry me now.
212-209-2950. Come on, people. You step out on faith here. Not just faith. We're giving you something solid and substantive. Transform your mind. Renew your mind. Blow your mind with the music and the information. 212-209-2950. Don't stop calling. We need you to persist and be determined and show what you're made of.
212-209-2950 is the number to call. We need your support. We need to understand that you're there. We need to feel you.
That's
we
it.
Need to see that phone, light up.
Thanks.
We need to hear it ring. We need to feel that you're out there because we're together. And as a matter of fact, while you're calling, we're going to be dancing. I'm going to be dancing with you. Here we go.
Folks. That's it. 212-209-2950. The bell's going to turn it out unless you all call. He's just
we
going
turn it
here.
Out, man. Turn it upside down. Egbe, me, oh.
Thank you for those callers who are persisting and are getting through. Thank you. And for allowing us to take those pledges and transform your mind. That's right, with information about the roots of physics and mathematics. 212, very popular package, 212-209-2950. You are doing the do, folks. You are doing the do. Where are my Sunrise committed fans?
That's coming, right. They're coming to see 4 of them online. 5.
That's it.
Oh, my Lord. Say it again.
Come on, Sunrise fans.
Sunrise.
From all around the region, Connecticut, Long Island.
Sunrise, what's wrong with you now?
Come on, Sunrise. Show them what you're made of. That's right. They say we're weak, Sunrise, but we're radical and
strong.
That's it. 212-209-2950. Yeah, come on, Sunrise. That's it.
Not turning back.
They stand by. They call.
Not turning back.
That's right. Those of you who leave voicemail.
You must be up by now. Come on.
That you love the station. You love Sunrise. That's it. Call. Help it keep happening. 212-209-2950.
As long as you're calling, I'll be checking it. I'll be checking it, checking it, checking it. Check this one out.
212-209-2950.
That's it?
This is nice.
That's the fun. That's the fun.
What is this, though? Oh, it's great. That's the fun one.
Hey!
Oh, it's nice.
We have about 10 more minutes to go on to the next package, and this is truly your very last chance to get this package because we have to move on. There's a lot more to be offered, and we're giving you the last chance to acquire get the African origins of mathematics and physics, or if you want to just get the African origins of mathematics, it's available for you for $100. If you want to get the African origins of physics, it's available to you for $75. If you want to get both African origins of mathematics and physics, you could get it for $150. And this is coming from those who have studied and researched and genuinely wanted to offer to the world the true history of this world. And they're quite credible. You could hear it.
All right, Tally, bring us up to date so we know where we are. Come on, Tally.
We have three callers on the line. We need more. Four now. Come on. 212-209-2950. There's no turning back. Because you know it too. No turning back. We have four callers.
That's
two,
it.
Three callers on the line. That's not enough. We need five more, 10 more, and we go to the next package. 2950.
209-20. So let's do it like this. We got three. Can we get four and five? Come on, four and five.
Sunrise.
Who are the committed, hardworking, dedicated? Come on, Sunrise.
Sunrise.
Out there, four and five. Come
Sunrise.
On, 212-209.
I ain't seen nothing.
No, me neither. 212.
Sunrise.
I'm getting nervous here. 212-209-2950.
This is problem.
Come on, Sunrise listeners.
Two minutes, no Sunrise.
You know what we do on
and the
Sunrise.
Already.
Make that call. Come on, let's vote. 212-209.
Uh-huh.
Oh, this music is something else.
Oh, yeah.
2950. Come on, let's see. We got three callers on the line. We need four, five, and six. Four, five, and will you be number four? Don't wait for your neighbor to do it. Thank you. Number four. There it is.
Next
come
one.
On, five. We're waiting for five. That's it. Come on, five. I know you're there, and you're going to dial 212-209-2950.
And keep on calling.
That's it. This is a great package.
Uh-huh.
There you are. Six and
we're moving
seven.
Up slowly and
right
slowly.
On the money.
Woo!
212-209-2950.
Uh-huh.
We need all of our African-American community to turn out. That's it. This information needs to infiltrate. 212-209-2950.
Ha! That's it. Oh, this is deep.
Thank you. Continue to dial 212-209-2950.
We're turning back now. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. Support what we do here. Support the feature of WBAI. Support whatever program you want to. But the only way to do it is to call these phone numbers. 212-209-2950 or this phone number. Only one phone number.
You did a great job.
212-209-2950 and let us know that you're out there. Let us know that you support the feature of the station. This is your very last chance to subscribe and be a member of the station up until I guess August or September. And we need you now, today, because if you're not here today, we may not be here tomorrow with you. And this is serious.
Continue to call.
This is serious. We want to end this thing. Today is the last day of the drive. We're not adding one more day because we know that you can't wait to get back to normal programming. We know some of you can't wait to hear from Democracy Now! Again. And after the drive, right after the drive, it will be here. Like every other program, we're all going to be here doing what we do every day like nothing ever happened. But with your support, it's going to make it sweeter. Uh-huh. Egbemiyo, carry me now. Oh.